We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined by my colleague, Christopher Bedford, senior editor at the Federalist, also a co-founder over at RightForge. Chris, thanks so much for stopping by.
Glad to be here.
You brought a giant beer.
You know, there's a hyper-liberal beer nerd store.
Yes.
Not too far from the office. That still makes you wear a mask when you're inside.
I think you just doxed us. There can't be many of those.
Well, no, it's a couple blocks away, but it's a big city.
Our podcast studio is in Nebraska.
It's in Nebraska. He's in a bunker. But they do have really good beer. Mm-hmm. So occasionally I swing by before our podcast when I'm in a good mood.
Yeah, he brought watermelon beer as well, which I actually really like, the Heller High Watermelon.
So yeah, the Heller High Watermelon is a wonderful beer. I first had it at like a beer festival in Massachusetts over a decade ago. And most of those fruit beers, you know, usually not it, but that one's perfect for like a 95 degree day, which it is today.
Shout out to a friend of the podcast, Wes Denton, for always stocking these up.
Good for him.
All right, so Chris, you've written, I think, a very helpful article about the future of the pro-life movement, but actually just really the future of the legal future of abortion in America. It's more complicated than people perhaps realize. I don't think anybody is celebrating Roe with the sense that the mission is accomplished and the day is done and we can sort of kick back. But that said, you provide, I think, a roadmap. Talk to us about it.
Well, this is another kind of thing where it's like a great mood that's tainted by some hard realities. And actually, to your point, the pro-life movement is super aware of these things.
Yes, and always has been.
Always has been. But you talk to anyone, and they're like, Roe is defeated, now the work begins, who's been involved with this. So that's, you contrast that. I would put the Dobbs case as the great victory of the modern American conservative movement, along with the defeat of the Soviet Union. Mm. Like, these are pinnacles that were said to be impossible, that we never stopped. And, well, unfortunately, we've lost on every single other part of American society. These are two crushing wins.
Mm.
You know, and it gives me hope. I mean, it gives me hope that this could be a tide turner or something. But there's a lot ahead of us. And I have been kind of down because I can foresee a future in 10 or so years where what was once Roe v. Wade is the law of the land by our legislature.
Mm.
And
easily can imagine that. Yeah.
Easily.
Yeah.
Not right now. Not until they have, I mean, they either get rid of the filibuster or get the supermajority. But I mean, these things happen. And the Democrats have shown that, unlike Republicans who love to tinker around the edges, Democrats are willing to sacrifice their power and their majority, which they know is temporary, to make seismic changes for their constituents and for their own beliefs. But just the beginning, we know it's going back to the states, but it's not even that simple, Roe v. Wade. So I went through a list of different district attorneys who'd signed a petition or a letter saying that they were going to refuse to enforce laws against abortion. I was just going for red state ones. We have Dallas, Texas, Corpus Christi, San Antonio, Houston, Austin, Texas, Atlanta, Georgia, all of its suburbs, Savannah, Augusta, Athens, Macon County, Arlington, Virginia, Fairfax, Falls Church, Norfolk, Loudoun County, Richmond, Portsmouth, Virginia, Birmingham, Alabama, Jackson, Mississippi, Nashville, Tennessee, Columbus, Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio, Indianapolis, St. Louis, Missouri, Asheville and Durham County, North Carolina, Lawrence, Kansas, Tampa, Florida. These are like just a smattering of places out of dozens that have said, we are going to refuse to enforce abortion law.
Blue dots and red seas.
Yes. And it's, you know, the founders created a system where there would be jealousy between different powers. And they'd check each other and they'd resist each other. Most of it's broken, like the legislative has surrendered to the executive. But the idea would be the legislature and the Supreme Court and the executive would put out their powers and be jealous of the other ones. It wasn't. The point of that jealousy does not extend to ideological pockets that ignore the citizenry and the will of the law, the people and the people's laws. And that's what we're getting. We're having laws that are being passed already, or pre-Roe law in Wisconsin that was iced by Roe, the original decision in 1973.
Yes. Yep.
That should have come right back into effect because it was like, oh, actually this law was constitutional. Well, the Attorney General of Wisconsin has sued to stop it. The governor said, we won't prosecute you, we'll defend you. The legislature has said, wait, we support this law. You're not going to do this. We're not going to strip it from the books. Judges in Louisiana and Utah have been blocking the implementation of laws. In Texas, the Attorney General Ken Paxton said, you can now prosecute based on pre-Roe v. Wade laws in your districts. A judge stopped that for a month or two to say, hold on a second. These laws that were constitutional and then made unconstitutional by a ridiculous ruling are still on the books. So there's going to be a lot of interstate fighting, a lot of chaos. And then you have the federal government, which has come in and has said, we're going to ship abortifacients to people in red states.
Right.
We're going to ship abortion pills to you. We're going to get... I mean, the idea that Elizabeth Warren and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez floated of setting up abortion clinics in national parks inside of red states. And it's like, okay, how about this? How about we put a gallows in national parks in blue states and return to, like, public executions for heinous crimes? Like, this is just such... These are such insane ideas that they're pushing forward. And they're going to do it. Yeah. They're going to do a lot of it. And they don't have the power right now in Congress, but...
Sanctuary cities, they've already done that.
Sanctuary cities, sanctuary counties, sanctuary states. Federal government pushing this as hard as they can. And I would fully expect a federal government that's willing to cut off a state's highway funds and infrastructure money if they don't listen to Mothers Against Drunk Driving and their shrill, like, ridiculous demands on raising the age from 20 to 21. They're willing to cut off poor kids' lunches if you don't let boys into little girls' rooms and elementary schools.
Yes.
Will absolutely try to strangle states for their federal funds if they don't allow for abortion.
By the way, do you know that support for you certainly know this, but support for abortion declines alongside income and education level, right? So the people least likely to support abortion in higher numbers are poorer and less educated. And the left has been making this case for the last week that this will hurt the working class disproportionately. And there's no question that, you know, if you have the money to pay to travel across state lines, whatever it is, you will benefit from this. And if you don't have that money, you will...
$5 a gallon, who does?
Yeah, right.
That was a dark joke,
but it's a true joke. One that actually Susie Weiss wrote about for Barry Weiss's newsletter on Thursday. And Chris, I'm just sort of wondering, I don't mean this pejoratively, I mean it literally, that was a negative explanation. What's the positive, the flip side, the positive, what should Republicans in red states with those blue dots be doing? What should Republicans on the national level be doing? What is the path right now to deal with these discrepancies?
Yeah, so that was the storm that's coming, and it is coming. And that doesn't even count the supermajority or the majority of the filibuster, less majority that they might potentially get. Not this time. I think they'd be crazy to cancel the filibuster before a red wave, and I think they know that. And I think that they're even too ideological to do, like, a passable, with Murkowski and Collins, the liberal Republican senators, a passable Roe bill that puts in parts of it to try and make Republicans look extreme and do protections. I don't even think they're going to do that because their party's too radical, and we'll call it lukewarm and pathetic and not enough. But the money stuff and all that is coming. Republicans have the options to fight back on this, and they must fight back viciously. On state level, Republicans have for a long time actually been, like, very good about this stuff.
Yes, yeah.
They need to start stripping money. I mean, Austin, Texas refuses to obey the law of Texas, which it has been for years. They need to strip its state funds. They need to play the same game the left is playing. They need to have Texas state troopers, the Texas Rangers, and the Attorney General going after people in these cities and prosecuting abortion doctors in these cities for them. You need to reach over and say, no, the state's power extends throughout the state. Austin is not a state. Corpus Christi, which is so disgusting and ironic to have
yes.
the abortion thing come from Corpus Christi, body of Christ. But they need to play that same kind of hardball. When they get into power in Washington, D.C., they need to strip funding that's going to these different things. They need to investigate and dig into any aspect of the federal government that is pushing this stuff. They need to strip it of its power. They need to abolish these things. They need to fire people. They can't just take away funding that can be replenished the next 2 years. But more so, the activists need to get up to date. And they have been doing this, but we need to expand it dramatically now. Abortion is something that most people in this country have not really thought too deeply about.
Yes.
Like, it's like, I know there's a fight somewhere. It's choice. It's the women. Some people say it's choice, and I get that. And it's a hard decision, according to Hillary Clinton. And they say it's murder, but I don't really know. It's so difficult to really understand because we've wrapped it as a society in so much different obfuscation and distraction.
There's no question that it's complicated, right? It's not a pure question of someone holding a gun to another person's head. There is another body involved. So that...
You can't see it.
Exactly.
Unless
exactly.
you see the pictures.
Exactly. Yep.
And when activists show people the pictures,
yes.
this is what it is. This child can feel pain. This child would survive. Doesn't even need to be incubated or put on tubes or given. Like, this child would survive.
In the late 90s, Naomi Wolf wrote an essay for the New Republic in which she said it is to the detriment of the pro-abortion movement that they don't acknowledge the pictures that pro-lifers use at their rallies and people who are against abortion use of babies in the womb, that those graphic, vivid, and disturbing images are real. And she said that in the late 90s, when she was still a fairly respected feminist writer and theorist, that it was that is to the detriment of the pro-choice movement, the pro-abortion movement.
Now they've embraced it, and I say
exactly,
yeah, and it's even more ghoulish.
Exactly, and you were at the court last week and saw you had posted a picture that went mega viral.
Mm-hmm.
Explain it.
It was a woman who was fully pregnant, like she could have been due any day now or week, and she had written on her belly what she was showing. This is not a human being. And it was awful.
Party of science, folks.
It was absolutely awful. That child would have survived. If she had been, if something awful had happened to her and she'd fallen and hit in her head or something and she was dying, the doctors could definitely have delivered that baby.
Of course.
And that baby would have lived and survived. So it's a strange cult of death on that. But it's hard. Well, because of that, a lot of politicians national politicians, don't know how to talk about it. They don't feel comfortable. So Republicans will get out there, and they'll feel super comfortable talking about taxes, spending, regulatory stuff, the military, war in Ukraine, war in Syria, war all over the world. These are things that they're comfortable talking about. It doesn't make them have to contemplate life, death,
mm-hmm.
reality, and sadness.
Or their voters.
Even should. Like, the right. question, like, they don't really have to. It looks like it's like a chess game.
Exactly.
But two... There's a massive industry of think tanks and people in D.C. and staffers who train them to talk like this. Like most of these...
They train the media as well. They literally have people at Planned Parenthood whose job it is to instruct the media and how to cover abortion, and the media dutifully replies. And you can see that. What was it? The CBS writer who covered abortion just went to work for Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, it was CBS or New York Times or something.
So it was too perfect.
Which is perfect, and I actually think it's great. Just go be a spokeswoman for that company.
It's a demotion, honestly. Yeah.
Yeah. We need to train the politicians. And we saw, if you look at, and I like this in the article, but if you go back and look at the 2016 Las Vegas debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, you get a full
mm-hmm.
imagery of exactly what this kind of training can do and exactly what cutting through the BS around abortion can teach people and make them more comfortable to talk about it. Because the left is always going to come, like Hillary did. This is the most difficult decision a woman will ever make in her life. You know, I was talking to Susie, and Susie had this condition, and it's like they do this thing as if it's not exactly what we see with the abortion on demand for
The pills, the writing on the belly that you documented.
So it's easy for politicians to just shrink like wallflowers when they hear this stuff.
Yep.
It's like, oh my gosh, it's a difficult decision. Girls, boomers, I don't know how to deal with it. And unless you say, yo, what she's talking about here, this difficult decision, is scrambling a living baby's brains and pulling it out piece by piece. So like, just keep your eye on the ball and don't be distracted by their nice words.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure, but as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this, and when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great, and right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza, so you can get buy one, get one free price pricing on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98, and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths, so you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows, you can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist.
So, some activists got into Donald Trump's ears. I've heard rumors that it was Marjorie Dannenfelter and other folks I've heard, but I'm not exactly sure who it was and who to give credit to. And we're like, this is what it is.
Yep.
Now, there's, like, no doubt that Donald Trump had not thought seriously in his long life about abortion. Like, he had a New York City real estate magnate and businessman. Before this election, abortion was not something he sat down and pondered, like, what does this mean? Mm-hmm. What is the impact on a child? What is the impact on a woman?
What is it physically? Legal? Yeah.
I mean, he was probably surrounded by friends who'd paid for these things. I'm sure he had some married buddies who got out of trouble by paying for this and throwing some cash to a cocktail waitress. Like, it's just not something that he really thought deeply about. But he came out on the 2016 debate stage after whatever conversations were being had and went right at Hillary Clinton and said, you know what this is, what she wants to do. And he was describing it with the visceral reaction of a convert.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what it was. And, like, I had never seen any candidate on the primary debate stage, like post-primary, like the general election debate stage, talk like that ever. And it blew my mind.
Let alone, like, even Republicans. It's just
Republicans.
Right. Yeah.
Never heard them talk like that. They say, I respect a woman's right to choose, but we respect life and things like that. They're just total cowards. Like George W. Bush, just like a total coward. He would campaign on this stuff and say all the right talking points while pointing his thumb at you. He hasn't even released a statement yet about Roe v. Wade and the Dobbs decision.
Yep.
He has time to meet with Zelensky and talk about more wars, but he's got no time to talk about this.
So like, who did, as you say, he campaigned on this?
Yeah, he campaigned
on
this.
He used it for votes.
He did. And Karl Rove, they used social conservatives the whole way through.
Although he nominated Alito.
He didn't want to.
Right. No, that's exactly.
We had to force him to do that.
Exactly. Yeah. And Casey was obviously, we can get in wrapped up in this. But
Roberts.
Yeah.
So we could train politicians to talk like this, and you have to give them that courage because Republicans are not people who've come here to change the world, generally, like left-wing Democratic politicians are. They're retired businessmen who want to put a cap on a successful career.
Yep.
Or, like, people who went to law school and are lawyers and, like, want to come here and do that. But, like, very few of them are, like, left or, like, the hardcore activists here to change the world. And they don't want to talk about issues that make them uncomfortable. And we have to make them feel comfortable talking about this because the battle's coming to Congress. They need to fight hard.
Okay, I am so glad you said that because it's an odd, if you look at public opinion polls, which should not, you know, necessarily always dictate public policy, but if you do look at public opinion polls, the country is a little bit mixed on abortion, right? Like very, very, very opposed to third trimester abortion, very in favor of legalized first trimester abortion and, you know, somewhere in the middle on the question. But I feel like the future, especially if Republicans get good at having these conversations about talking about it, is one in which it is so stigmatized for a Susan Collins or a Lisa Murkowski to be pro-abortion that even the, I don't know, the blue state Republicans, the blue state Republican members, the swing votes, right? Even for them, it would be beyond the pale. And the Democrats' extremism on the issue, I feel like, is a huge weapon in that. Like, and this is what Trump used, right? He absolutely used a hypothetical that is very much legalized and enabled by the Democratic and by Hillary Clinton's position on the issue to explain very persuasively and movingly what really happens.
So, like, I think that's completely right. And in the 80s and in the 90s and in the even in the 2000s, Republicans always had like a couple members, House or Senate, who their number one issue was abortion. They would hold up nominees for over abortion. They would hold up. They would refuse to do to join different votes. They would be a pain in the butt for the speakers and the majority leaders, even of their own party, based on abortion. There are members of Congress, Republican side, who've taken the pictures of abortion down to the floor of Congress. Or one took a baby doll and stabbed it repeatedly in the head to illustrate how a late-term abortion is actually mm-hmm. accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually, he ended up getting through the last abortion victory before the past year, which was the late-term abortion ban. We don't have those champions anymore. Like, there's no one whose number one issue, this is like the abortion guy. We have some people who do some good work on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But a lot of people don't. And you're talking about those polls. Molly Hemingway's got a really great piece out right now that's like, the Democrats have been kind of cooking these polls for a long time and have actually convinced themselves
yeah,
that they're true.
And that's another thing, yes.
There's going to be a backlash. But the reality is, you know, the culture has pushed abortion. The Hollywood's pushed abortion. Planned Parenthood's did a long, long campaign to sanitize their racism and their eugenics and make this like a thing about family planning.
Yes.
You go into these aisles and they call it family planning.
Mm-hmm.
The Planned Parenthood has the name of it. It's not like Abortion Central. It's Planned Parenthood. They've done all these different things to sanitize it, but we haven't really been fighting back vocally as loudly, I think, as we should have in some of the culture wars.
This,
on the state level, yes, unbelievable job. But if we get politicians and presidential candidates and people who can really, and senators who can really start to talk about this, and if we can get the heads of the top senators are on Fox News every single week. If you can get Lindsey Graham as comfortable talking about abortion and late-term abortion.
He's actually surprisingly good on abortion.
I just rarely see him on Fox News talking about it. Although, granted, companies like Fox News don't like to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
They absolutely don't
absolutely,
like to talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, their opinion hosts get at it, but yeah.
Some of them.
Yep.
But in general, like, it's an icky subject. It's a gross subject. People want to talk about it. And I want our politicians to be as comfortable talking about and defending this issue as they are defending unending wars, as they are defending tax cuts, as they are defending regulatory state, like whatever. I want them to be comfortable talking about this. I think we can get them there.
They should be. And there's a flip side of the coin in the question that I just asked you, which is a lot of devil's advocates here would say, but the Republican Party is going to go after Plan B and IVF and exceptions for rape and incest. And it's an interesting question because I think it's one that gets exactly at what you wrote about, which is the way we talk about this has to shift. And this is as good a time as any for that to happen, because if you talk about it, let's say, in the way that the media wanted it to be talked about during the war on women fear-mongering craze, it was though like, this is kind of hard to explain, but like, Republicans should be comfortable talking about abortion doing what it is, right? So like, explain when you're talking about why you don't support exceptions for rape and incest, explain why, and don't try to dodge that question. Embrace that question. Embrace this uncomfortable discussion about when life begins, because you are confident that you have a clear answer to it. And I feel like that sense of confidence now is the time to come at it, because you never would have seen Republicans talking to the media the way that they do 10 years ago, 20 years ago. They were terrified of these questions. Remember how terrified they were of getting Todd Akin in 2012 during the War on Women craze? They used to be really terrified of the media. Now you have Ron DeSantis, let alone Donald Trump. And
you know who's done surprisingly well in this? Who? Christy Noem.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, credit where it's due. She's learned a lesson and she came out, or maybe she just didn't think deeply enough about the trans issue or let the corporate lobbies get to her. But this one, she's been surprisingly good, and she's been bold, and she's been pushing back and saying, no, the federal government's not going to come in here and
that's right.
The citizens of South Dakota. That's completely insane.
That's right.
And good for her for doing that.
But this is, this is exactly what you wrote about. I think that, like, when media, over the last 5 years plus, media has been pretty healthily undermined by new media, and that's
by themselves.
Well, yeah, primarily by themselves, but then by new media. So, you know, one of the top news podcasts in the country is The Morning Wire by The Daily Wire, right? Like, they put that out every day, and it competes with whatever the New York Times, The Daily. Like, it's meant to be like that. And whereas conservative media might have done that 10 years ago, this is actually doing really well because the gatekeepers have less power than they used to. So now is the time to stop being afraid, to embrace what people clearly believe, and to have these conversations.
And that will shift those polls we were talking about.
Do you know how if there was somebody from the RNC in the room right now and I brought up IVF, they would freak the F out and they would be like, absolutely not. You're an idiot. You conservative movement armchair quarterbacks have no idea what you will cost the Republican Party, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We have undergone an obscene experiment over the last, half century when it comes to reproductive technology, when it comes to the abortion industry, which relies on reproductive technology.
I'm surprised, actually, to hear you say that. I didn't think that us papists had gained many allies on those sorts of fights. I thought we were alone on that rampart.
I'm a Lutheran, but I feel like it's pretty, a lot of people don't think, as you say, deeply about those questions. But one thing people forget, actually, is the Roseanne reboot. You did not expect me to go there. I can see it in your face. But hard pivot, the Roseanne reboot, one of the controversies that show brought up in the first episode was surrogacy. And that show was extremely deft about how it tapped into the very real divides that are ailing average American communities. Not, you know, people in Manhattan, but like people in the heartland.
Did you see that surrogacy photo shoot the other day? Of the gay couple embracing each other. Well, in the background, a Hispanic woman held her pregnant belly and her face was shrouded by her hair because you couldn't see it.
No.
It was like them doing a pregnancy shoot.
Okay, no,
this
I didn't
is what
see
we
that.
Brought. Or what was it? Andy Cohen.
Defrosting. Yeah.
Maybe my kids can defrost my
their siblings and raise them. Yep. Yeah.
I mean, so I know a lot of people who've been really helped and have been blessed with a family because of IVF.
Absolutely.
And people who struggled hard and wanted to, and they have children and like the different complications with their bodies that had made it difficult. But so it's a tough thing, but at the end of the day, like you have to look at like, okay, well, what's left over?
Mm-hmm.
Are there six eggs? Yep. Left over? Like, where are we now?
Can we defrost people and put them in a?
You can adopt them.
Yeah.
Did you know that? Women can adopt those and try to raise them. So they're called like star children or something.
Yeah.
This is a dark future we're living in.
No, it is.
But like we were talking about, it takes a lot of education. It takes cutting through a lot of feelings and a lot of BS to get to the hard reality of what this is.
But if you're a member listening to this or you're a consultant listening to it, bring it on. Please bring it on, because this is part of a broader narrative that people are starting to wake up to. And that's not to say I'm not dumb enough to think like, ooh, going after IVF is a political winner. But I do believe that it's not just that politics is downstream of culture, but that also culture is downstream of politics. And we have allowed the left to use the political arena to normalize.
And to define truth.
Yes, to bludgeon us out of that, to bludgeon what principle actually should exist in the conservative movement out of it, to make people apologize and hedge for years and years and years.
I mean, Roe is the basis of the pyramid that they've built, the foundation they've built of don't believe your lying eyes. What's false is true and what's true is false. That is not a baby. That is not a human. That is a choice made by a woman. You have no right to do it. It's like from there you get how can a white person talk about something affecting the black community or vice versa? How can a man talk about a woman? How dare you say that woman's a man? How dare you say that man's actually a woman?
Exactly.
Like, this whole thing is just, the children belong to the community, not you. It's like, all of these lies grow out of that initial lie about that is born at the genesis of life and where it's created. And it's like, shut your eyes and ignore it.
That's so true. And again, I think with the old guard, the legacy media's grip on the narrative starting to falter, which they still, this is not to diminish the fact that they still do have a lot of power, because they absolutely do, but it's waning. And if ever there were a moment to start being honest and respecting your voters, the people who elected you, and not being terrified to have these conversations with the media. Listen, I'm not saying it's going to be a political winner in every circumstance, but what I am saying is that there is a postmodern element of anti-human or transhumanism that has taken hold in this culture because Republicans have shied from the arena on these cultural issues. And people, we just talked about this with our colleague Eddie Scarry, who wrote a book called Liberal Misery. People are starting to pick up on the fact that there's a hole in them. They might not realize it's a God-shaped hole, but they realize that something is wrong. And if you are a Republican politician worth your salt, you should start talking to them in that context, because this is going, this is not something that humanity has ever seen in the scope of its existence on the face of this earth that has changed in the blink of an eye. You know, 500 years, I'm going to bring up the printing press again for Chris because he loves to do that. But, you know, these technologies have evolved so rapidly over the last half century.
Speaking of Lutheranism.
Yeah, our basic functions have
printing
changed.
Printing press and other tools of heresy.
Well, so but think of it like the pill, for instance. Mary Ebersat writes about this in Primal Screams, about how that has been like a radical change. It's a technology, and it has radically changed the way human beings relate to each other. We've mentioned this all the time in this podcast. Janet Yellen wrote a paper in the late 90s with her husband for Brookings.
The pill was like the cotton gin, where the cotton gin was invented by an abolitionist who wanted to make it so you didn't need to use humans to pick cotton. And it just ended up making cotton farms more efficient. You buy more slaves. And like, the pill is like supposed to liberate women.
Yeah.
And it actually just liberated men. It made us like have no responsibility and no connection. To
exactly. Women. Exploited women.
Exploited women.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's exactly what it did. And women have been, I don't know how Marxists aren't up in arms about the fact that corporations are eager, champing at the bit to pay for their female employees' abortions.
Freeze your eggs, put off marriage. I mean,
talk about exploitation.
Yeah, well, it's the handmaid's tale right there. But I mean, once you realize that corporate America is like a competitor with men in the modern dating and marriage market.
Yes,
it's like pretty insane. Like, how the heck are you going to date this girl when this guy, you know, promises her beanbag chairs and a paycheck and a promotion and to freeze her eggs and to put off her life, just work for me, and like here's a latte, and you're some dopey guy sitting there. I know that's kind of like a laughing take on it, but it's reality that corporations are competing
with
men and women for their youth.
Absolutely.
And their productivity.
Their humanity, though.
Yeah. And
their humanity.
I mean, I spent the first 2 hours of my day today getting a six-year-old ready, getting him to camp. He tried to sneak out without his underpants. I, like, caught him. He looks too happy. And I was like, are you wearing underpants? He goes, yes. I'm like, no, you're not. Go put them on. Like, how'd you know? Like, having a family does distract from your ability to work. For sure.
Yeah.
But it's the most rewarding thing you can possibly do.
Well, but that's to say, Republicans should absolutely talk about the stark reality here, but it can also be folded into this broader narrative about, as Eddie says, liberal misery, about how this postmodern order is destroying our humanity. I remember during the pandemic, the New York Times had, it was Hillsong, I believe. Hillsong was talking to the New York Times about how they had worked with Sheryl Sandberg on metaverse worship. And these things happen very, very quickly. You could say the same thing about the pill and industrialized high-tech abortion. You could say the same thing about a lot of things over the course of the last half century that have radically changed the way that we function in a basic sense as human beings. And they happen fast. And
sin begets sin.
Exactly. It's time for Republicans and actually Democrats as well to recognize how fundamentally life as a human being has been altered in the blink of an eye. And if you're afraid to talk about IVF, you're afraid to talk. And I'm not saying that IVF should be banned or outlawed, whatever. I don't have a fully formed opinion on this question. I am saying, though, that some of these new technologies,
the questions aren't being asked. That's what
they're not being asked.
What happens to the leftovers of this? If we're going to make humans, then it needs to just be more about like what makes us happy.
And it only gets worse the more casual we are about it.
Well, the whole thing has become what makes us happy.
Yes, because we have destroyed every foundation. And
marriage,
so it's pure hedonism.
Children. Yeah, marriage, children, sex, relationships, abortion. It's what makes you feel good.
Well,
it's like, well, you know, maybe there's something. And it's also very temporary.
Yeah.
All those things are very temporary. Which is why I think there's maybe part of the statistics for why there's more unhappiness in liberal marriages is like, what is this about? Is it about building
exactly.
a family and faith and religion to prosper and to, or is it about raising children? Or is it about like, man, I really like this guy or girl. We fit together well. It's romantic. You know, we have a lot of fun. She makes me laugh. You know, those are important. But that's not everything remotely. You need to have much more to it. And if you don't, you end up if you just chase that immediate happiness, you end up very unhappy.
Well, the most important attribute in a woman is birthing hips.
Childbearing hips.
You know, you're laughing, but biologically, that is really what you think. I think all of that is your point is very well taken. And I do hope people start to understand that this is part of something much, 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 much more serious. I mean, the forced pregnancy narrative, that language keeps getting thrown around by the left. And I wonder how powerful it is. I suspect it is probably very powerful.
It's a great word. It's much more useful piece of lie than ultra MAGA is.
Well, so women who are like me, let's say born in the early 90s, Roe was always settled law. It was untouchable. Abortion was just always a part of American culture and American law and American politics. It was really never going anywhere. Think about how psychologically that changed the way Xers, millennials, Zoomers have sex. We know that Gen Z is having sex at lower rates in older ages on average, and that the same was true of millennials. But let's think about this forced pregnancy language. That is implying the choice is whether or not to continue a pregnancy, not whether or not to have sex. But that is such a powerful phrase. It does conjure the Handmaid's Tale. But the choice in question, it's this idea that you should be able to chase pleasure, carnal pleasure, with no consequence, because that's what makes you equal to a man. And you are not equal to a man unless you have the ability to have sex with no consequence.
It's a pretty dark world.
Yes. Yes, it is. Christopher Bedford.
Do we have something more positive to end on? Watermelon, pretty good beer.
Yeah, we've got beer. They're still putting the Statue of Liberty on the beer, which I feel like is really positive, a good cultural signal.
Oh, yeah, this is a great brewing company. All their beers are patriotic.
And you're drinking something called Bluebird Bitter.
Bluebird Bitter.
Is it good?
Coniston Brewing Company. It's pretty darn good.
All right, then. Christopher Bedford, senior editor here at The Federalist, also co-founder over at RightForge. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to another edition of The Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.